The Lady with the Dog and Other Stories. The Lady with the Dog. It was said that a new person had appeared on the seafront, a lady with a little dog. Dmitry Dmitrich Gurov, who had by then been a fortnight at Yalta, and so was fairly at home there, had begun to take an interest in new arrivals. Sitting in Verney's pavilion, he saw, walking on the seafront, a fair-haired young lady of medium height, wearing a beret, a white Pomeranian dog was running behind her. And afterwards he met her in the public gardens and in the square several times a day. She was walking alone, always wearing the same beret, and always with the same white dog. No one knew who she was, and everyone called her simply the lady with the dog. If she is here alone without a husband or friends, it wouldn't be amiss to make her acquaintance, Gurov reflected. He was under 40, but he had a daughter already 12 years old, and two sons at school. He had been married young, when he was a student in his second year, and by now his wife seemed half as old again as he. She was a tall, erect woman with dark eyebrows, staid and dignified, and, as she said of herself, intellectual. She read a great deal, used phonetic spelling, called her husband, not Dmitry, but Dmitry, and he secretly considered her unintelligent, narrow, inelegant, was afraid of her, and did not like to be at home. He had begun being unfaithful to her long ago, had been unfaithful to her often, and, probably on that account, almost always spoke ill of women, and when they were talked about in his presence, used to call them the lower race. It seemed to him that he had been so schooled by bitter experience that he might call them what he liked, and yet he could not get on for 2 days together without the lower race. In the society of men he was bored and not himself, with them he was cold and uncommunicative, but when he was in the company of women he felt free, and knew what to say to them and how to behave, and he was at ease with them even when he was silent. In his appearance, in his character, in his whole nature, there was something attractive and elusive which allured women and disposed them in his favor. He knew that, and some force seemed to draw him, too, to them. Experience often repeated, truly bitter experience, had taught him long ago that with decent people, especially Moscow people, always slow to move and irresolute, every intimacy, which at first so agreeably diversifies life and appears a light and charming adventure, inevitably grows into a regular problem of extreme intricacy, and in the long run the situation becomes unbearable. But at every fresh meeting with an interesting woman this experience seemed to slip out of his memory, and he was eager for life, and everything seemed simple and amusing. One evening he was dining in the gardens, and the lady in the beret came up slowly to take the next table. Her expression, her gait, her dress, and the way she did her hair told him that she was a lady, that she was married, that she was in Yalta for the first time and alone, and that she was dull there. The stories told of the immorality in such places as Yalta are to a great extent untrue. He despised them, and knew that such stories were for the most part made up by persons who would themselves have been glad to sin if they had been able, but when the lady sat down at the next table 3 paces from him, he remembered these tales of easy conquests, of trips to the mountains, and the tempting thought of a swift, fleeting love affair, a romance with an unknown woman, whose name he did not know, suddenly took possession of him. He beckoned coaxingly to the Pomeranian, and when the dog came up to him he shook his finger at it. The Pomeranian growled. Gurov shook his finger at it again. The lady looked at him and at once dropped her eyes. "He doesn't bite," she said, and blushed. "May I give him a bone?" he asked, and when she nodded he asked courteously, "Have you been long in Yalta?"
5 days.
"And I have already dragged out a fortnight here." There was a brief silence. "Time goes fast, and yet it is so dull here," she said, not looking at him. "That's only the fashion to say it is dull here. A provincial will live in Belyaevorodina and not be dull, and when he comes here it's oh, the dullness. Oh, the dust. One would think he came from Grenada." She laughed. Then both continued eating in silence, like strangers, but after dinner they walked side by side, and there sprang up between them the light jesting conversation of people who are free and satisfied, to whom it does not matter where they go or what they talk about. They walked and talked of the strange light on the sea. The water was of a soft warm lilac hue, and there was a golden streak from the moon upon it. They talked of how sultry it was after a hot day. Gurov told her that he came from Moscow, that he had taken his degree in arts, but had a post in a bank, that he had trained as an opera singer, but had given it up, that he owned 2 houses in Moscow. And from her he learnt that she had grown up in Petersburg, but had lived in S, since her marriage 2 years before, that she was staying another month in Yalta, and that her husband, who needed a holiday too, might perhaps come and fetch her. She was not sure whether her husband had a post in a crown department or under the provincial council and was amused by her own ignorance. And Gurov learned, too, that she was called Anna Sergeyevna. Afterwards he thought about her in his room at the hotel, thought she would certainly meet him next day, it would be sure to happen. As he got into bed he thought how lately she had been a girl at school, doing lessons like his own daughter. He recalled the diffidence, the angularity, that was still manifest in her laugh and her manner of talking with a stranger. This must have been the first time in her life she had been alone in surroundings in which she was followed, looked at, and spoken to merely from a secret motive which she could hardly fail to guess. He recalled her slender, delicate neck, her lovely gray eyes. There's something pathetic about her, anyway, he thought, and fell asleep. A week had passed since they had made acquaintance. It was a holiday. It was sultry indoors, while in the street the wind whirled the dust round and round, and blew people's hats off. It was a thirsty day, and Gurov often went into the pavilion, and pressed Anna Sergeyevna to have syrup and water or ice. One did not know what to do with oneself. In the evening when the wind had dropped a little, they went out on the groin to see the steamer come in. There were a great many people walking about the harbor, they had gathered to welcome someone, bringing bouquets. And two peculiarities of a well-dressed Yalta crowd were very conspicuous: the elderly ladies were dressed like young ones, and there were great numbers of generals. Owing to the roughness of the sea, the steamer arrived late, after the sun had set, and it was a long time turning about before it reached the groin. Anna Sergeyevna looked through her lorgnette at the steamer and the passengers as though looking for acquaintances, and when she turned to Gurov her eyes were shining. She talked a great deal and asked disconnected questions, forgetting next moment what she had asked, then she dropped her lorgnette in the crush. The festive crowd began to disperse, it was too dark to see people's faces. The wind had completely dropped, but Gurov and Anna Sergeyevna still stood as though waiting to see someone else come from the steamer. Anna Sergeyevna was silent now, and sniffed the flowers without looking at Gurov. "The weather is better this evening," he said. "Where shall we go now? Shall we drive somewhere?" She made no answer. Then he looked at her intently, and all at once put his arm round her and kissed her on the lips, and breathed in the moisture and the fragrance of the flowers, and he immediately looked round him, anxiously wondering whether anyone had seen them. "Let us go to your hotel," he said softly. And both walked quickly. The room was close and smelt of the scent she had bought at the Japanese shop. Gurov looked at her and thought, what different people one meets in the world. From the past he preserved memories of careless, good-natured women, who loved cheerfully and were grateful to him for the happiness he gave them, however brief it might be, and of women like his wife who loved without any genuine feeling, with superfluous phrases, affectedly, hysterically, with an expression that suggested that it was not love nor passion, but something more significant, and of two or three others, very beautiful, cold women, on whose faces he had caught a glimpse of a rapacious expression and obstinate desire to snatch from life more than it could give, and these were capricious, unreflecting, domineering, unintelligent women not in their first youth, and when Gurov grew cold to them their beauty excited his hatred, and the lace on their linen seemed to him like scales. But in this case there was still the diffidence, the angularity of inexperienced youth, an awkward feeling, and there was a sense of consternation as though someone had suddenly knocked at the door. The attitude of Anna Sergeyevna, the lady with the dog, to what had happened was somehow peculiar, very grave, as though it were her fault so it seemed, and it was strange and inappropriate. Her face dropped and faded, and on both sides of it her long hair hung down mournfully. She mused in a dejected attitude like the woman who was a sinner in an old-fashioned picture. "It's wrong," she said. "You'll be the first to despise me now." There was a watermelon on the table. Gurov cut himself a slice and began eating it without haste. There followed at least half an hour of silence. Anna Sergeyevna was touching, there was about her the purity of a good, simple woman who had seen little of life. The solitary candle burning on the table threw a faint light on her face, yet it was clear that she was very unhappy. "How could I despise you?" asked Gurov. "You don't know what you are saying." "God forgive me," she said, and her eyes filled with tears. "It's awful. You seem to feel you need to be forgiven." "Forgiven? No. I am a bad, low woman, I despise myself and don't attempt to justify myself. It's not my husband but myself I have deceived. And not only just now, I have been deceiving myself for a long time. My husband may be a good, honest man, but he is a flunky. I don't know what he does there, what his work is, but I know he is a flunky. I was 20 when I was married to him. I have been tormented by curiosity, I wanted something better. There must be a different sort of life, I said to myself. I wanted to live. To live, to live. I was fired by curiosity, you don't understand it, but, I swear to God, I could not control myself, something happened to me, I could not be restrained. I told my husband I was ill. and came here. And here I have been walking about as though I were dazed, like a mad creature, and now I have become a vulgar, contemptible woman whom anyone may despise." Gurov felt bored already, listening to her. He was irritated by the naive tone, by this remorse, so unexpected and inopportune, but for the tears in her eyes, he might have thought she was jesting or playing a part. "I don't understand," he said softly. "What is it you want?" She hid her face on his breast and pressed close to him. Believe me, I beseech you," she said. "I love a pure, honest life, and sin is loathsome to me. I don't know what I am doing. Simple people say, the evil one has beguiled me. And I may say of myself now that the evil one has beguiled me." "Hush, hush," he muttered. He looked at her fixed, scared eyes, kissed her, talked softly and affectionately, and by degrees she was comforted, and her gaiety returned, they both began laughing. Afterwards when they went out there was not a soul on the seafront. The town with its cypresses had quite a death-like air, but the sea still broke noisily on the shore, a single barge was rocking on the waves, and a lantern was blinking sleepily on it. They found a cab and drove to Orienta. "I found out your surname in the hall just now, it was written on the board von Diderits," said Gurov. "Is your husband a German?" "No, I believe his grandfather was a German, but he is an Orthodox Russian himself." At Orienta they sat on a seat not far from the church, looked down at the sea, and were silent. Yalta was hardly visible through the morning mist, white clouds stood motionless on the mountaintops. The leaves did not stir on the trees, grasshoppers chirruped, and the monotonous hollow sound of the sea rising up from below, spoke of the peace, of the eternal sleep awaiting us. So it must have sounded when there was no Yalta, no Orienta here, so it sounds now, and it will sound as indifferently and monotonously when we are all no more. And in this constancy, in this complete indifference to the life and death of each of us, there lies hid, perhaps, a pledge of our eternal salvation, of the unceasing movement of life upon earth, of unceasing progress towards perfection. Sitting beside a young woman who in the dawn seemed so lovely, soothed and spellbound in these magical surroundings, the sea, mountains, clouds, the open sky, Gurov thought how in reality everything is beautiful in this world when one reflects, everything except what we think or do ourselves when we forget our human dignity and the higher aims of our existence. A man walked up to them, probably a keeper looked at them and walked away. And this detail seemed mysterious and beautiful, too. They saw a steamer come from Theodosia, with its lights out in the glow of dawn. "There is dew on the grass," said Anna Sergeyevna, after a silence. "Yes. It's time to go home." They went back to the town. Then they met every day at 12 o'clock on the seafront, lunched and dined together, went for walks, admired the sea. She complained that she slept badly, that her heart throbbed violently, asked the same questions, troubled now by jealousy and now by the fear that he did not respect her sufficiently. And often in the square or gardens, when there was no one near them, he suddenly drew her to him and kissed her passionately. Complete idleness, these kisses in broad daylight while he looked round in dread of someone seeing them, the heat, the smell of the sea, and the continual passing to and fro before him of idle, well-dressed, well-fed people, made a new man of him. He told Anna Sergeyevna how beautiful she was, how fascinating. He was impatiently passionate, he would not move a step away from her, while she was often pensive and continually urged him to confess that he did not respect her, did not love her in the least, and thought of her as nothing but a common woman. Rather late almost every evening they drove somewhere out of town, to Orienta or to the waterfall, and the expedition was always a success, the scenery invariably impressed them as grand and beautiful. They were expecting her husband to come, but a letter came from him, saying that there was something wrong with his eyes, and he entreated his wife to come home as quickly as possible. Anna Sergeyevna made haste to go. "It's a good thing I am going away," she said to Gurov. "It's the finger of destiny." She went by coach and he went with her. They were driving the whole day. When she had got into a compartment of the express, and when the second bell had rung, she said, "Let me look at you once more, look at you once again." "That's right." She did not shed tears, but was so sad that she seemed ill, and her face was quivering. "I shall remember you, think of you," she said. "God be with you, be happy. Don't remember evil against me. We are parting forever, it must be so, for we ought never to have met. Well, God be with you." The train moved off rapidly, its lights soon vanished from sight, and a minute later there was no sound of it, as though everything had conspired together to end as quickly as possible that sweet delirium, that madness. Left alone on the platform, and gazing into the dark distance, Gurv listened to the chirrup of the grasshoppers and the hum of the telegraph wires, feeling as though he had only just waked up. And he thought, musing, that there had been another episode or adventure in his life, and it, too, was at an end, and nothing was left of it but a memory. He was moved, sad, and conscious of a slight remorse. This young woman whom he would never meet again had not been happy with him. He was genuinely warm and affectionate with her, but yet in his manner, his tone, and his caresses there had been a shade of light irony, the coarse condescension of a happy man who was, besides, almost twice her age. All the time she had called him kind, exceptional, lofty, obviously he had seemed to her different from what he really was, so he had unintentionally deceived her. Here at the station was already a scent of autumn. It was a cold evening. "It's time for me to go north," thought Gurv as he left the platform. High time. At home in Moscow everything was in its winter routine, the stoves were heated, and in the morning it was still dark when the children were having breakfast and getting ready for school, and the nurse would light the lamp for a short time. The frosts had begun already. When the first snow has fallen, on the first day of sledge driving it is pleasant to see the white earth, the white roofs, to draw soft, delicious breath, and the season brings back the days of one's youth. The old limes and birches, white with hoarfrost, have a good-natured expression, they are nearer to one's heart than cypresses and palms, and near them one doesn't want to be thinking of the sea and the mountains. Gurv was Moscow-born. He arrived in Moscow on a fine frosty day, and when he put on his fur coat and warm gloves, and walked along Petrovka, and when on Saturday evening he heard the ringing of the bells, his recent trip and the places he had seen lost all charm for him. Little by little he became absorbed in Moscow life, greedily read three newspapers a day, and declared he did not read the Moscow papers on principle. He already felt a longing to go to restaurants, clubs, dinner parties, anniversary celebrations, and he felt flattered at entertaining distinguished lawyers and artists, and at playing cards with a professor at the doctor's club. He could already eat a whole plateful of salt fish and cabbage. In another month, he fancied, the image of Anna Sergeyevna would be shrouded in a mist in his memory, and only from time to time would visit him in his dreams with a touching smile as others did. But more than a month passed, real winter had come, and everything was still clear in his memory as though he had parted with Anna Sergeyevna only the day before. And his memories glowed more and more vividly. When in the evening stillness he heard from his study the voices of his children, preparing their lessons, or when he listened to a song or the organ at the restaurant, or the storm howled in the chimney, suddenly everything would rise up in his memory, what had happened on the groin, and the early morning with the mist on the mountains, and the steamer coming from Theodosia, and the kisses. He would pace a long time about his room, remembering it all and smiling, then his memories passed into dreams, and in his fancy the past was mingled with what was to come. Anna Sergeyevna did not visit him in dreams, but followed him about everywhere like a shadow and haunted him. When he shut his eyes he saw her as though she were living before him, and she seemed to him lovelier, younger, tenderer than she was, and he imagined himself finer than he had been in Yalta. In the evening she peeped out at him from the bookcase, from the fireplace, from the corner he heard her breathing, the caressing rustle of her dress. In the street he watched the women, looking for someone like her. He was tormented by an intense desire to confide his memories to someone. But in his home it was impossible to talk of his love, and he had no one outside. He could not talk to his tenants nor to anyone at the bank. And what had he to talk of? Had he been in love, then? Had there been anything beautiful, poetical, or edifying or simply interesting in his relations with Anna Sergeyevna? And there was nothing for him but to talk vaguely of love, of woman, and no one guessed what it meant, only his wife twitched her black eyebrows, and said, "The part of a lady killer does not suit you at all, Dmitri." One evening, coming out of the doctor's club with an official with whom he had been playing cards, he could not resist saying, "If only you knew what a fascinating woman I made the acquaintance of in Yalta." The official got into his sledge and was driving away, but turned suddenly and shouted, "Dmitri Dmitrich!" "What?" "You were right this evening, the sturgeon was a bit too strong." These words, so ordinary, for some reason moved Gurv to indignation, and struck him as degrading and unclean. What savage manners, what people! What senseless nights, what uninteresting, uneventful days! The rage for card playing, the gluttony, the drunkenness, the continual talk always about the same thing. Useless pursuits and conversations always about the same things absorb the better part of one's time, the better part of one's strength, and in the end there is left a life groveling and curtailed, worthless and trivial, and there is no escaping or getting away from it just as though one were in a madhouse or a prison. Gurv did not sleep all night, and was filled with indignation. And he had a headache all next day. And the next night he slept badly. He sat up in bed, thinking, or paced up and down his room. He was sick of his children, sick of the bank. He had no desire to go anywhere or to talk of anything. In the holidays in December he prepared for a journey, and told his wife he was going to Petersburg to do something in the interests of a young friend, and he set off for S. What for? He did not very well know himself. He wanted to see Anna Sergeyevna and to talk with her to arrange a meeting, if possible. He reached S. in the morning, and took the best room at the hotel, in which the floor was covered with grey army cloth, and on the table was an inkstand, grey with dust and adorned with a figure on horseback, with its hat in its hand and its head broken off. The hotel porter gave him the necessary information. Von Dieteritz lived in a house of his own in Old Goncharny Street. It was not far from the hotel. He was rich and lived in good style, and had his own horses. Everyone in the town knew him. The porter pronounced the name Dieteritz. Gurov went without haste to Old Goncharny Street and found the house. Just opposite the house stretched a long grey fence adorned with nails. One would run away from a fence like that, thought Gurov, looking from the fence to the windows of the house and back again. He considered, today was a holiday, and the husband would probably be at home. And in any case it would be tactless to go into the house and upset her. If he were to send her a note it might fall into her husband's hands, and then it might ruin everything. The best thing was to trust to chance. And he kept walking up and down the street by the fence, waiting for the chance. He saw a beggar go in at the gate and dogs fly at him. Then an hour later he heard a piano, and the sounds were faint and indistinct. Probably it was Anna Sergeyevna playing. The front door suddenly opened, and an old woman came out, followed by the familiar white Pomeranian. Gurov was on the point of calling to the dog, but his heart began beating violently, and in his excitement he could not remember the dog's name. He walked up and down, and loathed the grey fence more and more, and by now he thought irritably that Anna Sergeyevna had forgotten him, and was perhaps already amusing herself with someone else, and that was very natural in a young woman who had nothing to look at from morning till night but that confounded fence. He went back to his hotel room and sat for a long while on the sofa, not knowing what to do. Then he had dinner and a long nap. How stupid and worrying it is! He thought when he woke and looked at the dark windows, it was already evening. Here I've had a good sleep for some reason. What shall I do in the night? He sat on the bed, which was covered by a cheap grey blanket, such as one sees in hospitals, and he taunted himself in his vexation. So much for the lady with the dog, so much for the adventure. You're in a nice fix. That morning at the station a poster in large letters had caught his eye. The geisha was to be performed for the first time. He thought of this and went to the theater. It's quite possible she may go to the first performance, he thought. The theater was full. As in all provincial theaters, there was a fog above the chandelier. The gallery was noisy and restless. In the front row the local dandies were standing up before the beginning of the performance, with their hands behind them. In the governor's box the governor's daughter, wearing a boa, was sitting in the front seat, while the governor himself lurked modestly behind the curtain with only his hands visible. The orchestra was a long time tuning up, the stage curtain swayed. All the time the audience were coming in and taking their seats Gurov looked at them eagerly. Anna Sergeyevna, too, came in. She sat down in the third row, and when Gurov looked at her his heart contracted, and he understood clearly that for him there was in the whole world no creature so near, so precious, and so important to him. She, this little woman, in no way remarkable, lost in a provincial crowd, with a vulgar lorgnette in her hand, filled his whole life now, was his sorrow and his joy, the one happiness that he now desired for himself. And to the sounds of the inferior orchestra, of the wretched provincial violins, he thought how lovely she was. He thought and dreamed. A young man with small side whiskers, tall and stooping, came in with Anna Sergeyevna and sat down beside her. He bent his head at every step and seemed to be continually bowing. Most likely this was the husband whom at Yalta, in a rush of bitter feeling, she had called a flunky. And there really was in his long figure, his side whiskers, and the small bald patch on his head, something of the flunky's obsequiousness. His smile was sugary, and in his buttonhole there was some badge of distinction like the number on a waiter. During the first interval the husband went away to smoke, she remained alone in her stall. Gurov, who was sitting in the stalls, too, went up to her and said in a trembling voice, with a forced smile, "Good evening." She glanced at him and turned pale, then glanced again with horror, unable to believe her eyes, and tightly gripped the fan and the lorgnette in her hands, evidently struggling with herself not to faint. Both were silent. She was sitting, he was standing, frightened by her confusion and not venturing to sit down beside her. The violins and the flute began tuning up. He felt suddenly frightened. It seemed as though all the people in the boxes were looking at them. She got up and went quickly to the door. He followed her, and both walked senselessly along passages, and up and down stairs, and figures in legal, scholastic, and civil service uniforms, all wearing badges, flitted before their eyes. They caught glimpses of ladies, of fur coats hanging on pegs, the drafts blew on them, bringing a smell of stale tobacco. And Gaurav, whose heart was beating violently, thought, "Oh, heavens! Why are these people here in this orchestra?" And at that instant he recalled how when he had seen Anna Sergeyevna off at the station he had thought that everything was over and they would never meet again. But how far they were still from the end. On the narrow, gloomy staircase over which was written to the amphitheater, she stopped. "How you have frightened me," she said, breathing hard, still pale and overwhelmed. "Oh, how you have frightened me. I am half dead. Why have you come? Why?" "But do understand, Anna, do understand," he said hastily in a low voice. "I entreat you to understand." She looked at him with dread, with entreaty, with love. She looked at him intently, to keep his features more distinctly in her memory. "I am so unhappy," she went on, not heeding him. "I have thought of nothing but you all the time. I live only in the thought of you. And I wanted to forget you, but why, oh, why, have you come?" On the landing above them two schoolboys were smoking and looking down, but that was nothing to Gaurav. He drew Anna Sergeyevna to him, and began kissing her face, her cheeks, and her hands. "What are you doing, what are you doing?" she cried in horror, pushing him away. "We are mad. Go away today, go away at once. I beseech you by all that is sacred, I implore you. There are people coming this way." Someone was coming up the stairs. "You must go away," Anna Sergeyevna went on in a whisper. "Do you hear, Dmitri Dmitrich? I will come and see you in Moscow. I have never been happy, I am miserable now, and I never, never shall be happy, never. Don't make me suffer still more. I swear I'll come to Moscow. But now let us part. My precious, good, dear one, we must part." She pressed his hand and began rapidly going downstairs, looking round at him, and from her eyes he could see that she really was unhappy. Gaurav stood for a little while, listened, then, when all sound had died away, he found his coat and left the theater. And Anna Sergeyevna began coming to see him in Moscow. Once in 2 or 3 months she left S, telling her husband that she was going to consult a doctor about an internal complaint, and her husband believed her, and did not believe her. In Moscow she stayed at the Slavyansky Bazaar Hotel, and at once sent a man in a red cap to Gaurav. Gaurav went to see her, and no one in Moscow knew of it. Once he was going to see her in this way on a winter morning, the messenger had come the evening before when he was out. With him walked his daughter, whom he wanted to take to school. It was on the way. Snow was falling in big wet flakes. "It's 3 degrees above freezing point, and yet it is snowing," said Gaurav to his daughter. "The thaw is only on the surface of the earth, there is quite a different temperature at a greater height in the atmosphere." "And why are there no thunderstorms in the winter, father?" He explained that, too. He talked, thinking all the while that he was going to see her, and no living soul knew of it, and probably never would know. He had two lives, one, open, seen and known by all who cared to know, full of relative truth and of relative falsehood, exactly like the lives of his friends and acquaintances, and another life running its course in secret. And through some strange, perhaps accidental, conjunction of circumstances, everything that was essential, of interest and of value to him, everything in which he was sincere and did not deceive himself, everything that made the kernel of his life, was hidden from other people, and all that was false in him, the sheath in which he hid himself to conceal the truth, such, for instance, as his work in the bank, his discussions at the club, his lower race, his presence with his wife at anniversary festivities, all that was open. And he judged of others by himself, not believing in what he saw, and always believing that every man had his real, most interesting life under the cover of secrecy and under the cover of night. All personal life rested on secrecy, and possibly it was partly on that account that civilized man was so nervously anxious that personal privacy should be respected. After leaving his daughter at school, Gaurav went on to the Slavyansky Bazaar. He took off his fur coat below, went upstairs, and softly knocked at the door. Anna Sergeyevna, wearing his favorite gray dress, exhausted by the journey and the suspense, had been expecting him since the evening before. She was pale, she looked at him, and did not smile, and he had hardly come in when she fell on his breast. Their kiss was slow and prolonged, as though they had not met for 2 years. "Well, how are you getting on there?" he asked. "What news?" Wait, I'll tell you directly. I can't talk. She could not speak, she was crying. She turned away from him, and pressed her handkerchief to her eyes. Let her have her cry out. I'll sit down and wait, he thought, and he sat down in an armchair. Then he rang and asked for tea to be brought him, and while he drank his tea she remained standing at the window with her back to him. She was crying from emotion, from the miserable consciousness that their life was so hard for them, they could only meet in secret, hiding themselves from people, like thieves. Was not their life shattered? Come, do stop, he said. It was evident to him that this love of theirs would not soon be over, that he could not see the end of it. Anna Sergeyevna grew more and more attached to him. She adored him, and it was unthinkable to say to her that it was bound to have an end someday. Besides, she would not have believed it. He went up to her and took her by the shoulders to say something affectionate and cheering, and at that moment he saw himself in the looking glass. His hair was already beginning to turn gray. And it seemed strange to him that he had grown so much older, so much plainer during the last few years. The shoulders on which his hands rested were warm and quivering. He felt compassion for this life, still so warm and lovely, but probably already not far from beginning to fade and wither like his own. Why did she love him so much? He always seemed to women different from what he was, and they loved in him not himself, but the man created by their imagination, whom they had been eagerly seeking all their lives, and afterwards, when they noticed their mistake, they loved him all the same. And not one of them had been happy with him. Time passed, he had made their acquaintance, got on with them, parted, but he had never once loved. It was anything you like, but not love. And only now when his head was gray he had fallen properly, really in love for the first time in his life. Anna Sergeyevna and he loved each other like people very close and akin, like husband and wife, like tender friends. It seemed to them that fate itself had meant them for one another, and they could not understand why he had a wife and she a husband, and it was as though they were a pair of birds of passage, caught and forced to live in different cages. They forgave each other for what they were ashamed of in their past, they forgave everything in the present, and felt that this love of theirs had changed them both. In moments of depression in the past he had comforted himself with any arguments that came into his mind, but now he no longer cared for arguments, he felt profound compassion, he wanted to be sincere and tender. "Don't cry, my darling," he said. "You've had your cry, that's enough. Let us talk now, let us think of some plan." Then they spent a long while taking counsel together, talked of how to avoid the necessity for secrecy, for deception, for living in different towns and not seeing each other for long at a time. How could they be free from this intolerable bondage? "How? How?" he asked, clutching his head. "How?" And it seemed as though in a little while the solution would be found, and then a new and splendid life would begin. And it was clear to both of them that they had still a long, long road before them, and that the most complicated and difficult part of it was only just beginning. A doctor's visit. The professor received a telegram from the Lyalikovs' factory. He was asked to come as quickly as possible. The daughter of some Madame Lyalikov, apparently the owner of the factory, was ill, and that was all that one could make out of the long, incoherent telegram. And the professor did not go himself, but sent instead his assistant, Kirillov. It was two stations from Moscow, and there was a drive of 3 miles from the station. A carriage with 3 horses had been sent to the station to meet Kirillov. The coachman wore a hat with a peacock's feather on it, and answered every question in a loud voice like a soldier, "No, sir. Certainly, sir." It was Saturday evening, the sun was setting, the work people were coming in crowds from the factory to the station, and they bowed to the carriage in which Kirillov was driving. And he was charmed with the evening, the farmhouses and villas on the road, and the birch trees, and the quiet atmosphere all around, when the fields and woods and the sun seemed preparing, like the workpeople now on the eve of the holiday, to rest, and perhaps to pray. He was born and had grown up in Moscow, he did not know the country, and he had never taken any interest in factories, or been inside one, but he had happened to read about factories, and had been in the houses of manufacturers and had talked to them, and whenever he saw a factory far or near, he always thought how quiet and peaceable it was outside. But within there was always sure to be impenetrable ignorance and dull egoism on the side of the owners, wearisome, unhealthy toil on the side of the workpeople, squabbling, vermin, vodka. And now when the workpeople timidly and respectfully made way for the carriage, in their faces, their caps, their walk, he read physical impurity, drunkenness, nervous exhaustion, bewilderment. They drove in at the factory gates. On each side he caught glimpses of the little houses of workpeople, of the faces of women, of quilts and linen on the railings. "Look out!" shouted the coachman, not pulling up the horses. It was a wide courtyard without grass, with five immense blocks of buildings with tall chimneys a little distance one from another, warehouses and barracks, and over everything a sort of gray powder as though from dust. Here and there, like oases in the desert, there were pitiful gardens, and the green and red roofs of the houses in which the managers and clerks lived. The coachman suddenly pulled up the horses, and the carriage stopped at the house, which had been newly painted gray. Here was a flower garden, with a lilac bush covered with dust, and on the yellow steps at the front door there was a strong smell of paint. "Please come in, doctor," said women's voices in the passage and the entry, and at the same time he heard sighs and whisperings. "Pray walk in. We've been expecting you so long, we're in real trouble. Here, this way." Madame Lyalikov, a stout elderly lady wearing a black silk dress with fashionable sleeves, but, judging from her face, a simple and educated woman, looked at the doctor in a flutter, and could not bring herself to hold out her hand to him. She did not dare. Beside her stood a personage with short hair and a pince-nez. She was wearing a blouse of many colors, and was very thin and no longer young. The servants called her Kristina Dmitrievna, and Kurlov guessed that this was the governess. Probably, as the person of most education in the house, she had been charged to meet and receive the doctor, for she began immediately, in great haste, stating the causes of the illness, giving trivial and tiresome details, but without saying who was ill or what was the matter. The doctor and the governess were sitting talking while the lady of the house stood motionless at the door, waiting. From the conversation Kurlov learned that the patient was Madame Lyalikov's only daughter and heiress, a girl of 20, called Liza. She had been ill for a long time, and had consulted various doctors, and the previous night she had suffered till morning from such violent palpitations of the heart, that no one in the house had slept, and they had been afraid she might die. "She has been, one may say, ailing from a child," said Kristina Dmitrievna in a sing-song voice, continually wiping her lips with her hand. "The doctors say it is nerves. When she was a little girl she was scrofulous, and the doctors drove it inwards, so I think it may be due to that." They went to see the invalid. Fully grown up, big and tall, but ugly like her mother, with the same little eyes and disproportionate breadth of the lower part of the face, lying with her hair in disorder, muffled up to the chin, she made upon Kurlov at the first minute the impression of a poor, destitute creature, sheltered and cared for here out of charity, and he could hardly believe that this was the heiress of the five huge buildings. "I am the doctor come to see you," said Kurlov. "Good evening." He mentioned his name and pressed her hand, a large, cold, ugly hand. She sat up, and, evidently accustomed to doctors, let herself be sounded, without showing the least concern that her shoulders and chest were uncovered. "I have palpitations of the heart," she said. "It was so awful all night. I almost died of fright. Do give me something."
I will, don't worry yourself." Kurlov examined her and shrugged his shoulders. "The heart is all right," he said. "It's all going on satisfactorily, everything is in good order. Your nerves must have been playing pranks a little, but that's so common. The attack is over by now, one must suppose. Lie down and go to sleep." At that moment a lamp was brought into the bedroom. The patient screwed up her eyes at the light, then suddenly put her hands to her head and broke into sobs. And the impression of a destitute, ugly creature vanished, and Kurlov no longer noticed the little eyes or the heavy development of the lower part of the face. He saw a soft, suffering expression which was intelligent and touching. She seemed to him altogether graceful, feminine, and simple, and he longed to soothe her, not with drugs, not with advice, but with simple, kindly words. Her mother put her arms round her head and hugged her. What despair, what grief was in the old woman's face! She, her mother, had reared her and brought her up, spared nothing, and devoted her whole life to having her daughter taught French, dancing, music, had engaged a dozen teachers for her, had consulted the best doctors, kept a governess. And now she could not make out the reason of these tears. Why there was all this misery, she could not understand, and was bewildered, and she had a guilty, agitated, despairing expression, as though she had omitted something very important, had left something undone, had neglected to call in somebody in whom, she did not know. "Lizanka, you are crying again, again," she said, hugging her daughter to her. "My own, my darling, my child, tell me what it is. Have pity on me. Tell me." Both wept bitterly. Kurlov sat down on the side of the bed and took Liza's hand. "Come, give over, it's no use crying," he said kindly. "Why, there is nothing in the world that is worth those tears. Come, we won't cry, that's no good." And inwardly he thought, "It's high time she was married." Our doctor at the factory gave her calibromati, said the governess, but I notice it only makes her worse. I should have thought that if she is given anything for the heart it ought to be drops. I forget the name. Convalaria, isn't it? And there followed all sorts of details. She interrupted the doctor, preventing his speaking, and there was a look of effort on her face, as though she supposed that, as the woman of most education in the house, she was duty-bound to keep up a conversation with the doctor, and on no other subject but medicine. Kurloff felt bored. I find nothing special the matter, he said, addressing the mother as he went out of the bedroom. If your daughter is being attended by the factory doctor, let him go on attending her. The treatment so far has been perfectly correct, and I see no reason for changing your doctor. Why change? It's such an ordinary trouble, there's nothing seriously wrong. He spoke deliberately as he put on his gloves, while Madame Lyalikov stood without moving, and looked at him with her tearful eyes. I have half an hour to catch the 10 o'clock train, he said. I hope I am not too late. And can't you stay? She asked, and tears trickled down her cheeks again. I am ashamed to trouble you, but if you would be so good. For God's sake, she went on in an undertone, glancing towards the door, do stay tonight with us. She is all I have, my only daughter. She frightened me last night, I can't get over it. Don't go away, for goodness sake. He wanted to tell her that he had a great deal of work in Moscow, that his family were expecting him home, it was disagreeable to him to spend the evening and the whole night in a strange house quite needlessly, but he looked at her face, heaved a sigh, and began taking off his gloves without a word. All the lamps and candles were lighted in his honor in the drawing room and the dining room. He sat down at the piano and began turning over the music. Then he looked at the pictures on the walls, at the portraits. The pictures, oil paintings in gold frames, were views of the Crimea, a stormy sea with a ship, a Catholic monk with a wine glass. They were all dull, smooth daubs, with no trace of talent in them. There was not a single good-looking face among the portraits, nothing but broad cheekbones and astonished-looking eyes. Lyalikov, Liza's father, had a low forehead and a self-satisfied expression, his uniform sat like a sack on his bulky plebeian figure, on his breast was a medal and a Red Cross badge. There was little sign of culture, and the luxury was senseless and haphazard, and was as ill-fitting as the uniform. The floors irritated him with their brilliant polish, the lusters on the chandelier irritated him, and he was reminded for some reason of the story of the merchant who used to go to the baths with a medal on his neck. He heard a whispering in the entry, someone was softly snoring. And suddenly from outside came harsh, abrupt, metallic sounds, such as Kurloff had never heard before, and which he did not understand now. They roused strange, unpleasant echoes in his soul. I believe nothing would induce me to remain here to live, he thought, and went back to the music books again. Doctor, please come to supper. The governess called him in a low voice. He went into supper. The table was large and laid with a vast number of dishes and wines, but there were only two to supper, himself and Kristina Dmitrievna. She drank Madeira, ate rapidly, and talked, looking at him through her pince-nez. Our workpeople are very contented. We have performances at the factory every winter, the workpeople act themselves. They have lectures with a magic lantern, a splendid tea room, and everything they want. They are very much attached to us, and when they heard that Lizanka was worse they had a service sung for her. Though they have no education, they have their feelings, too. It looks as though you have no man in the house at all, said Kurloff. Not one. Pyotr Nikanorich died a year and a half ago, and left us alone. And so there are the three of us. In the summer we live here, and in winter we live in Moscow, in Polyanka. I have been living with them for 11 years as one of the family. At supper they served sterlet, chicken rissoles, and stewed fruit, the wines were expensive French wines. Please don't stand on ceremony, doctor, said Kristina Dmitrievna, eating and wiping her mouth with her fist, and it was evident she found her life here exceedingly pleasant. Please have some more. After supper the doctor was shown to his room, where a bed had been made up for him, but he did not feel sleepy. The room was stuffy and it smelt of paint, he put on his coat and went out. It was cool in the open air, there was already a glimmer of dawn, and all the five blocks of buildings, with their tall chimneys, barracks, and warehouses, were distinctly outlined against the damp air. As it was a holiday, they were not working, and the windows were dark, and in only one of the buildings was there a furnace burning, two windows were crimson, and fire mixed with smoke came from time to time from the chimney. Far away beyond the yard the frogs were croaking and the nightingales singing. Looking at the factory buildings and the barracks, where the workpeople were asleep, he thought again what he always thought when he saw a factory. They may have performances for the workpeople, magic lanterns, factory doctors, and improvements of all sorts, but, all the same, the workpeople he had met that day on his way from the station did not look in any way different from those he had known long ago in his childhood, before there were factory performances and improvements. As a doctor accustomed to judging correctly of chronic complaints, the radical cause of which was incomprehensible and incurable, he looked upon factories as something baffling, the cause of which also was obscure and not removable, and all the improvements in the life of the factory hands he looked upon not as superfluous, but as comparable with the treatment of incurable illnesses. There is something baffling in it, of course, he thought, looking at the crimson windows. 1,500 or 2,000 workpeople are working without rest in unhealthy surroundings, making bad cotton goods, living on the verge of starvation, and only waking from this nightmare at rare intervals in the tavern. 100 people act as overseers, and the whole life of that 100 is spent in imposing fines, in abuse, in injustice, and only 2 or 3 so-called owners enjoy the profits, though they don't work at all, and despise the wretched cotton. But what are the profits, and how do they enjoy them?